Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
And also, it's very difficult to know, you know, the verdict. You don't have the verdict whether you've survived it or not. The tremors of these things continue, you know, to... This is why I don't understand, you know, when people say, have you found closure? I don't... And I'm sympathetic with the... I appreciate the sentiment. The sentiment is, you know, I hope you feel better. I hope you could put this away and get on with it, you know, with life. And but it seems to me it's the, you know, I'm not interested really in things that close. I'm interested in openings. I'm interested in knowledge and really thinking about these things. I find vitality in that. It's not easy, of course, but I find vitality in it.
Does grief divide? Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. In his emotive new memoir, The Return, Libyan writer Hisham Matar states, "I've always detested the confusion of funerals, the uncertainty of cemeteries, the bewilderment of the headstone. One of the injustices involved in disappearing a person is a difficult one to describe. It turns the disappeared into an abstraction." Hisham goes on to write, "The question of what father went through during his captivity continues to haunt me." Well, this week I had the very great pleasure of talking with Hisham Matar on his powerful new memoir, The Return, published by The Viking Press.
My name is Hisham Matar. I'm a Libyan writer, but a Libyan writer with a complicated history. I was born in New York. And I've lived part of my life in Libya and in Egypt and most of it in London. The book that I'm about to read to you from is my latest book, and it's a memoir that I've written after returning home to Libya after 33 years of not being able to go there. So it's the book is called The Return, and it is really provoked by this trip back. I'll read from the beginning. Chapter 1, Trapdoor. Early morning, March 2012, my mother, my wife Diana, and I were sitting in a row of seats that were bolted to the tiled floor of a lounge in Cairo International Airport. Flight 835 for Benghazi, a voice announced, was due to depart on time. Every now and then, my mother glanced anxiously at me. Diana, too, seemed concerned. She placed a hand on my arm and smiled. I should get up and walk around, I told myself. But my body remained rigid. I had never felt more capable of stillness. The terminal was nearly empty. There was only one man sitting opposite us. He was overweight, weary-looking, possibly in his mid-50s. There was something in the way he sat, the locked hands on the lap, the left tilt of the torso, that signaled resignation. Was he Egyptian or Libyan? Was he on a visit to the neighboring country or going home after the revolution? Had he been for or against Gaddafi? Perhaps he was one of those undecided ones who held their reservations close to their chest. The voice of the announcer returned. It was time to board. I found myself standing at the front of the line, Diana beside me. She had, on more than one occasion, taken me to the town where she was born in Northern California. I know the plants and the color of the light and the distances where she grew up. Now I was finally taking her to my land. She had packed the Hasselblad and the Leica, her two favorite cameras. 100 rolls of film. Diana works with great fidelity. Once she gets hold of a thread, she will follow it until the end. Knowing this excited and worried me. I'm reluctant to give Libya any more than it has already taken. Mother was pacing by the windows that looked onto the runway. speaking on her mobile phone. People, mostly men, began to fill the terminal. Diana and I were now standing at the head of a long line, bent behind us like a river. I pretended I had forgotten something and pulled her to one side. Returning after all these years was a bad idea, I suddenly thought. My family had left in 1979, 33 years earlier. This was the chasm that divided the man from the 8-year-old boy I was then. The plane was going to cross the Gulf. Surely such journeys were reckless. This one could rob me of a skill that I have worked hard to cultivate, how to live away from places and people I love. Joseph Brodsky was right. So were Nabokov and Conrad. They were artists who never returned. Each had tried, in his own way, to cure himself of his country. What you have left behind has dissolved. Return, and you will face the absence or the defacement of what you treasured. But Dmitri Shostakovich and Boris Pasternak and Naguib Mahfouz were also right. Never leave the homeland. Leave, and your connections to the source will be severed. You'll be like a dead trunk, hard and hollow. What do you do when you cannot leave and cannot return?
Really well done on the book, Hisham. It's a remarkable read. It's hugely courageous. There's a subtlety to it. There's a poetry to it. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with, and I'm just going to pick up some of the words that you do use. Is grief a faraway country? How do you understand it all?
I don't know what grief is. This is part of, I think, of the motor behind the book, is trying to understand it, to engage with it. I think one of the effects of this experience, of going through these events, of, you know, experiencing the disappearance of your father, of not being able to return to the country that you're from, living in another language, writing in another language, one of the sensations that at least it inflicts on me is the sense of drowning, you know, is the sense of being as though history exists against you. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book, or one of the things that I'm engaging with, is to try to do the opposite, to sort of create a space for my consciousness, you know, space where articulation is possible and where I can not take anything for granted, where I can think, in other words, about grief in a way that doesn't feel inherited, you know. And so one of the things that grief is, I think, is a much more dynamic space than I had, or at least culture had suggested to me. I think we, particularly in our time, we are very uneasy around grief. We are uneasy around the bereaved, and we never know what to say, we never know how to fix it. And these and so many other articulations of our responses, I think, say something to us about our relationship to it. And one of the things that I found out through my experience is that it's actually a very vibrant, you know, painful, hard work, but it's a very vibrant space. And in our impatient, confessional tendencies, sometimes we want to somehow do away with these things, you know, with things like grief and frustration, boredom. These things can be incredibly interesting and creative spaces. Not pleasant, obviously, but so I felt that we overlook sometimes what grief is, and I wanted to meditate over it, think about it, and other things that have come along with this experience.
Well, you can't control grief. And in your case, there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty onto how your father died and where he was. Can you describe your father, Jabala? He was an extraordinary man. He had so many different talents. Can you describe him?
Yeah, no, this is, I think, part of, again, one of the motivations for writing the book, paradoxically, is that I can't describe him. Trying to describe my father is a bit like trying to describe myself. You know, it's impossible to me. I don't have an authority on it, you know, to be able to. And I think it says something about the nature of intimacy, is that he's so close that he is that I can't really see him properly. And the experience of losing him the way I did, where, you know, he disappeared, and for the majority of my life, and I'm now 45, he was kidnapped from his home in Cairo and taken to Libya, and then eventually disappears in the political prison. But when that happened, I was 19. So for this amount of time, my relationship to his loss is complex, because, you know, when you lose somebody to death, and I have lost dear people to me in that way, it's very painful. It's also very ambiguous and complex. But at least there's a certainty. You know, at this particular moment, they cease to exist in the ways that we know of, at least, regardless of what beliefs we might have about the afterlife. But when somebody disappears, the quality of your hours is touched by them all the time. You know, the possibility of them existing at this exact moment, you know, not abstractly, but exactly at this second, under the same sun, under the same moon, is a vivid and real one. And it changes the way you walk, the way you eat, you know, the way you sleep. And also, I think one of the deep injustices involved in disappearance is that it also complicates your memory of the person. So one of the things that was going on in the book is me trying to really attend to my memory of him, trying to answer the question that you've just asked me, you know. And I describe him. To what extent do I know him? But yes, I mean, for your listeners, and in very kind of brief way, you know, he was, you know, many things. He was a military man before the coup in 1969 that brought Gaddafi. Then he was a reluctant diplomat in New York, which is why I was born here. In America. And then he, you know, resigned because the Gaddafi regime tore up the constitution and announced Gaddafi de facto leader forever and imprisoned a few dissidents and so on. And that was the moment my father resigned and we moved back to Libya. He became an entrepreneur, and then we went to Egypt and he became very, very involved in the exiled opposition movements and became one of its most effective leaders, which is why in 1990 he was abducted and taken secretly to a prison in Libya and disappears. From the prison, he sends letters. We received three letters that were smuggled out of prison, eventually reached us. And they are remarkable. You know, they have in them his whole self. So they're amazing documents. And again, those are, you know, so I'm trying, you know, to attend to the man I knew as a boy and the man I knew when I was a teenager, and then also the man that I knew after he disappeared, you know, through these letters and through the testimonies and stories that I heard from fellow prisoners. And so it's a story. You know, what was really interesting in the writing of it is that having not written a memoir before, I've written two novels before, and I know the thrill and excitement of being caught up in the activity of the imagination. You know, that's just one of my favorite things about writing. And so I had wrongly assumed that writing a memoir would somehow diminish that, because I'm writing a lot of things that I know about or have happened. And so it's a different kind of imaginative engagement with memory. But because the story has in it a lot of black holes, things that I don't know, what happened to my father. I don't know what his quiet hours were like in prison. And those are things that I've spent a very long time quietly thinking about them, not able to share my thinking about them, even with my mother and my brother, because they're painful thing. And so when I came to write this book, you know, as exact and authentic and faithful as I am trying to be to past events, my imagination was, as it were, co-remembering with me. It was a very interesting surprise, imaginatively, and made writing the book a real paradox, because as you know, it's a very painful book to have written. It's an emotional, psychological space that was very difficult to sustain over the 3 years that it took to write it, which is why, you know, it feels when I look back on it, I am thrilled that I've written it, but I'm also thrilled that I had the stamina to write it. You know, it was very humanistically, I'm not even talking creatively here, humanistically, it was very difficult to, it demanded certain muscles from me that were perhaps not as developed as I wanted them to be. And so it was quite a process in that way. But, you know, but the paradox is that notwithstanding all these difficulties, it was thrilling to write because creatively it was demanding a lot of things from me, and always felt like the novel, always felt just around the corner of my abilities, just out of reach of what I might be able to pull off. And that's what excites me as a writer, is being kept on my toes in this way. That's why it always feels like a high wire act that, you know, you might not make it. You know, I really do think books are our fate. And this book, regardless of my personal fate that made it necessary, which I regret and really deeply hope, wish it were otherwise, you know, I feel very, I felt very lucky, you know, to have this book work on as an artist, because I felt it was better than me. You know, that's what you want to feel as a writer.
That's a remarkable statement to make, Hisham. You talk a lot about absent presence throughout the book, and you write that need and uncertainty can be excellent teachers. And then you go on to write, I have always wondered if it is possible to lose your father without sensing that particular moment of his death. On the 29th of June 1996, 1,270 Libyans were executed in Abu Salem prison. And there is a huge possibility that your father was one of them. And that Saturday morning, you visited the National Gallery. It was part of your routine, I think. And that day you were sitting in front of the execution of Maximilian. I think you got up early in the morning. You were very unsettled. And that Edward Manet painting is a picture of a political execution. It's a firing line. That is remarkable, that here you are in the National Gallery, and whether how we are in synergy or not with those we love all around us.
Yes, no, I discovered that when I was writing the book, that was, I didn't know it then. I was trying to work on a part of the book that articulates my thinking about my father's absence, disappearance, and recalling how when I was in my early 20s, I was secretly consoled by the thought that it would be impossible to lose someone that close to you without you sensing it in the moments of your day. And I had heard a Syrian poet who was visiting London to give a reading say in a radio interview that he was staying at a hotel in London, and he walked out and walked in the green nearby and suddenly recalled his mother in a very powerful way and felt very tearful. Went back to the hotel, found a message from his brother saying that his mother just passed away. And I was it made perfect sense to me. I thought, of course, you know, that's a very reasonable thing to happen. And surely that would happen to me too if my father were killed, which meant, because it didn't happen, that my father was, you know, continuing to live on this earth. And so I found this thought consoling. And then later on, when it became evident that my father, you know, after the revolution and so on, very recently became evident that, you know, at least through the laws of deduction, my father, you know, is not alive. I was unsettled by this, that could happen, that somehow I was capable of continuing to live without any sense of what was happening to my father. And of course, it's one of the outrageous facts about us as human beings, that you and I, as we are talking now, there are people dying and terrible things are happening in the world. And so I thought, as I was writing all of this, I thought I should consult my diaries, because I'm not a regular diarist. I mean, there are years when there's only four entries or something. But I thought maybe on the day of the massacre, which is, as you said, the most probable date of my father's death, what was I doing? Did I write something in my diary? And I found the diary of that year, and I found there is an entry on that on that day, on in fact the same morning as they were being executed and, you know, stuffed in a big mass grave in the prison. I decided to switch that day my vigil, which was also a result of losing my father. My relationship to art became very complicated when I was 19, when I lost my father. I just basically couldn't look at paintings in the way that people do, you know, where you go to an exhibit and you start from one end and you follow through, come to the end and you walk out and go have a cup of coffee or something. I just couldn't do that. And it drove me crazy. And there was something in art for me that I wanted, but I didn't know how to do it. So I thought, to solve this problem, I will choose one painting and go to it every day for 15 minutes and look at it for 15 minutes and go. So that was just something that I had developed to solve what I had hoped was a temporary problem. Well, the problem continues with me until today. That's still how I look at work. I pick a painting and I look at it for a number of weeks or months sometimes, and then I switch to another one. I'm grateful for it because, you know, I still don't know how to look at a painting, and this seems to me a fruitful engagement. But then it was just a response to an anxiety. And that day I switched from a painting by Velázquez to a painting by Manet that was the execution of Maximilian. Not only a painting of a political execution, but arguably the most, if you had to choose one painting in the National Gallery that best articulates the inconclusive fate of the men who died in the Abu Sim massacre, it would be that one, because parts of it are missing. It was cut up and put together by the National Gallery. I think it was in 1992 they put it all together. And there are parts of it that are still missing. Most importantly, Maximilian himself. You don't see him. You just see his hand holding one of his generals next to him. And so, yes, things, coincidences like that, the peculiar thing about them is actually how natural they seem, you know? It seems like that's what happens.
You write, the country that separates fathers and sons has disorientated many travellers. It is very easy to get lost, sir. In March 2012, I think it was, you arrived in Tripoli with your mother and your wife, Diana. That must have been such a tricky trip to navigate, because I imagine at lots of stages in it, you've pulled back and second-guessed yourself and wondered, well, what am I doing here?
I remember long time ago listening to an old interview that Nabokov gave to the BBC radio. And in it, the interviewer asks him, do you desire ever to return to your Russia? And he says to him, no, I have no desire to go back. There's nothing in it for me. It's not beautiful. Any village in Italy has buildings that are more splendid than the entire country of Russia. And also, when I go back, I will have to witness the decimation of the Russia that I knew as a child. And I remember listening to that and thinking, you know, it doesn't make sense, but I'm not like that. My interest in my relationship to the past is not one where I want to preserve it, you know, or idealize it in some way. I've always been interested in the earth. You know, I'm interested in the dust and in the unevenness of reality. And I wanted to be re-engaged with the land, you know, as the Palestinian poet Reed Barghouti says, the land is amoral. No, the land is indifferent to all of this.
It's a great way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah. And so I wanted to be with, you know, the land. And the land, of course, for me also includes blood. You know, it also includes my relatives, my cousins, the men and women that I grew up with when I was a boy. You know, I wanted to see them. I wanted to be confronted with the reality of them, of how they've changed and what they've become, and see myself with them, you know, to see what that tells me about myself. So it was motivated by, you know, a genuine desire and, you know, a common sense of longing for my country and my people, but it was also, the artist in me also wanted to be nudged by reality. I've always felt that's where everything is. You know, I've always felt that. Although the paradox, of course, is I'm writing about the past, but I really always feel that I'm writing about the present. No, about and yes, you're right. It did feel very dangerous. It felt scary, and not in the obvious sense, you know, because there was a civil war or something, and there wasn't then. Then it was a calm time, a very exciting time. It wasn't that. It was more that I would somehow be unmade in some way.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, tonight I'm talking with Hisham Matter on his compelling new memoir, The Return, Fathers, Sons and the Land in Between, published by The Viking Press. To be a man, writes Libyan novelist Hisham Matter, is to be a part of a chain of gratitude and remembering, of blame and forgetting, of surrender and rebellion, until a son's gaze is made so wounded and keen that on looking back, he sees nothing but shadows. I asked Hisham about everyday life under Gaddafi and the repressive censorship that came with his regime. Hisham writes, Gaddafi, like a crazy jealous lover, infiltrated every aspect of public and private life. I asked Hisham how artists and writers pragmatically coped under these oppressive measures.
Yes, but in a limited way. You know, I mean, ultimately, the dictatorship, any dictatorship, succeeds and fails. You know, the human resilience is amazing, but it also succeeds in limiting the horizons. You know, it has, in very material, real, empirical sense, damaged Libyan literature. You know, and you know, when you put writers in prison, when you close bookshops and limit the stocks of libraries, when you complicate university education, it has a real, you know, effect. But you know, to understand, I feel, to understand really the present, to understand why Libya is the way it is and the various challenges that face it, it is really important to engage with, you know, great interest and curiosity in the reality of life under the dictatorship for you know, four decades that many Libyans endured. And because it's quite unique, Gaddafi was quite unique, and you know, he had many postures and internationally that were you know, advocating, although more rhetorically than genuinely, you know, independence, anti-imperialism, all of these things that we all feel very passionate about. And therefore, he managed to, through his rhetoric and through his funding of various third world or international sort of freedom fighters, freedom, you know, so-called. And so he managed to spread an image of, you know, a man who is for liberty and so on. And that added a, you know, a layer of isolation for many Libyans who were genuinely wanting liberty and democracy and so on. Because you had, in other words, the powers colluding with him in order to get his oil and so on, not his oil, our oil, I should say. But also you had, you know, the left found it very difficult to know what to do with Gaddafi because they saw him as an ally. And so it really isolated Libyans even more. That. So the experience under him was very lonesome for a lot of Libyans. You know, was difficult to find allies.
Hisham, you're right. When Gaddafi took my father, he placed me in a space not much bigger than the cell father was in. And you talk a lot about the guilt that you experienced, wondering where was your father, at what moment did he die, how did he understand that whole environment and how you understood all of that. And you write, guilt is exile's eternal companion. It stains every departure. When you have your personal grief, your family's grief, and also the collective grief of a country, and you're all trying to come to grips with disappearances and absences. How does a country, how does a family, how do you all live with that uncertainty and the other issues that those uncertainties bring up?
I suppose you do that independently. You know, I say somewhere in the book that grief is a divider. That as tightly as we all held on to each other to share our confusion and despair and grief, you experience it alone. And that's the nature of it, that no two people, regardless how close, experience the same loss in the same way or witness it evolve in their life, you know, in the same way. You know, I don't know how, I mean, I don't know what the measure of doing it well is, right? I mean, I don't know what would be the model of a successful response.
Hisham, you ask an unbelievably powerful question in the book. You ask, is there an achievement greater than surviving suffering? And it's an impossible undertaking, really, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it is. It's and also, it's very difficult to know, you know, the verdict. You don't have the verdict whether you've survived it or not, but because it's the tremors of these things continue, you know, to... This is why I don't understand, you know, when people say, you know, have you found closure? I don't... And I'm sympathetic with the... you know, I appreciate the sentiment. The sentiment is, you know, I hope you feel better. I hope you could put this away and get on with it, you know, with life. And but it seems to me it's the... You know, I'm not interested really in things that close. I'm interested in openings. I'm interested in knowledge and really thinking about these things. I find vitality in that. I don't, it's not easy, of course, but I find vitality in it. I'm not, I'm a sucker for comfort. You know, I love comfort, but intellectually as an artist, I love that kind of work. So I, yeah, so for me, none of it closes. And so the surviving suffering when I see it in others, it's so inspiring. I mean, I think I said that in the book in response to my uncle, Mahmoud, who experienced, you know, 21 years of political imprisonment, terrible things that had happened to him. And he turned to me and he said, you know, there's nothing that they didn't do to me, but I've always kept place in my mind. It was interesting that he said in my mind, not in my heart, yeah. In my mind, where they couldn't get to it, you know, and in that place, I was able to love. I was able to love everyone. It was remarkable to me that it was really quite quite stunning. And so I said that I think, at least now, when you tell me, when you quote to me that line, that's what I think of. But in my own personal life, I have no clue whether I've survived anything, you know.
The Libyan desk officer for the British government, Declan Byrne, described to you, used a word that I found intriguing but a little alarming as well, the British diplomatic relationship with Libya. It was in 2010, I think you met with Declan, when you were trying to ask a question, I think it was in House of Lords, on the welfare of your father and his whereabouts. And you were dealing with David Miliband at the time. And Declan described the relationship as leveraged engagement. Now, you'd lived in Britain for maybe 15, 20 years at the time. How does that word sit with you, with what you know now?
Well, I mean, it reminded me of that phrase that Margaret Thatcher used to use with South Africa, you know, that it was a constructive engagement, you know, to work with the apartheid regime. No, I mean, I think the history of relations between Britain and Libya with the Gaddafi regime were, you know, it was parasitic, you know, it was the responses, what can we get out of this? It's deeply cynical. It, in very material, real terms, extended the life of Gaddafi. You know, when Tony Blair went there in 2003, the legitimacy that the regime had, the fact that he extended the regime's reach and the regime was able to kidnap and not even had to kidnap. It was delivered to them by America and Britain through rendition. Dissidents abroad that they tortured. It made life for people like me who are outspoken about the human rights situation in Libya complicated. It's not an honorable chapter. And the hope when the revolution happened, is that whole relationship can be redefined. You know, that it could be that, you know, one could feel audacious enough to hope that men and women of culture and justice would engage with one another. You know, surely for their own interests, but that they see that their interests lies also in the well-being of others. And so my experience then as a Libyan was I used to always have this image actually of this man, you know, who your neighbor, who you know is raping and beating his wife. You see her coming out bruised and you continue dealing with him. You continue selling him things and, you know, wanting to be friends with him and so on. I refuse for this to be taken as an idealistic position. It's not an idealistic position. I mean, that's how one lives one's life, no?
I found reading about how you had to deal with Gaddafi's son, who was quite an operator, to put it mildly. But throughout all of that experience, you reminded yourself always of consoling words your father used to say to you. He used to quote to you a chapter from the Quran, and it goes something on the lines of, "With hardship comes ease. With hardship comes ease." How do you understand that ease that your father was describing now to you?
At the risk of, there's always a problem with a book like this, that it's taken as a kind of, I don't know, like a cathartic, self-indulgent act. I didn't feel it to be that way at all. I felt something else working on it. But having finished or gone through the process that the thing, all the various things that I had to go through before I got to the book, I do feel that that with a kind of gentle attentiveness to hardship, and that's a big thing because it's not always possible, comes mysteriously a kind of ease. I do feel that. I mean, I'm very surprised. Now, I'm speaking very personally here. It's not really about the book at all, but I am always taken aback by the kind of gentleness that I feel.
Lastly, you write, "My father is both dead and alive. I do not have a grammar for him. He's in the past, he's in the present and the future." That's extraordinarily poetic, and it's very, very consoling to anyone who's lost a parent or a loved one. Do you think that we all have to understand, wherever our loss, our estrangement, our uncertainties, that we have to just give space? Is that it?
Of course, the circumstances are very particular and also peculiar, because not hopefully, we live in a world where this is very rare, right? That people lose someone in this way. Yet, I was very hopeful as I was working and keen to make sure that the book isn't about some, its value isn't about how unusual this is. It's more actually the opposite, and how the emotions, the situations that this inflicts are actually astonishing, exactly for how shared they are. You know, how this, I say it in the book that we all, that I'm no different. We all live in the aftermath. And it seems to me a very simple and an astonishing fact that, that all of us at this exact moment have, the weight of people behind us and events behind us. But each one of us has a line of people standing behind them. And that to me seems like such an invigorating, exciting invitation into the present, but also into history. The particular details of how I lost my father add something to that line that you quote about that he exists, in all temporal spaces, and that I don't have a grammar for him. That was that had a very real reason, because I didn't know whether he's alive or dead. But I think, even if I had lost him in a way that was more natural, I think I would still feel that way, that there are moments when he feels very, very present. And other people that I've lost, that I've lost to death, and that, they feel also very, very present. So that to me is something that is interesting about time, but also interesting about the nature of intimacy and memory and grief,
Thank you.
And that was Libyan novelist Hisham Matar. The Return, Father, Sons and the Land in Between is published by the Viking Press and retails for just under €17 in paperback or €7 on an ebook. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Burnock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with some gentle and beautiful words Jabala Matar wrote in a letter to his wife and sons from Abu Salem prison in Libya. "Don't worry, I am well. I am like the mountain that is neither altered nor diminished by the passing storms." Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.